Welcome to the second episode of Building AI Products, a practical podcast for people who build AI, machine learning, and data science products. I'm your host, Raf Lee. There's a lot of hype in the world of machine learning right now, most of it created by big ideas people putting out unfalsifiable speculation about what the future will look like. In the meantime, the builders who are actually making and shipping AI products are following a boring playbook that just works, doing customer discovery, prototyping, experimenting, and iterating. On Building AI Products, we interview those people, the people in the trenches building stuff. Today, my guest is Sasha Londi. She's worked in data science for 11 years, most recently at Warby Parker as their director of data science, where she ran a centralized team that did statistical modeling, BI training and analyst support, and machine learning. She's also the founder of Women Who Code, and grew it to its first 2,000 members in 3 cities, back before events for women programmers were commonplace. We actually met as teaching volunteers at a Rails coding bootcamp in 2010. Before going into tech, she was a teacher who taught physics, neuroscience, and weightlifting. She's currently an executive and leadership coach, working with leaders and founders of small to medium-sized tech companies. Sasha is one of those wonderful high IQ, high EQ, left-right brained people who's both super technical and a great people manager. So today we'll be talking about how she structured her data science team at Warby, about the powerful questions she uses to scope projects with non-data practitioners, and about keeping the peace between centralized data scientists and embedded data analysts. Let's dive in. Welcome to the show, Sasha.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. So you were at Warby Parker for over 6 years, and you managed data science teams for over half of that time. And I wanted to start off by asking you about something, to my knowledge, vexes all data scientists and machine learning engineers and their teams and managers. And it's this problem, which is that the task of like working on a model and polishing it up is never really done, right? Like in theory, you could always spend more time on it. And my observation has been that data practitioners are always asking themselves, should I continue working on this model and make it like 1% better, 5% better, or should I move on to something else? Could you walk us through how you and your teams dealt with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we as data science practitioners are often vexed by various things. So I love that you used that word. The key challenge is that because you can structure your work iteratively, like you can get a base level model up and running that does pretty good. And then you can like bring in more data sources to make it more nuanced. You can do some feature engineering to get more of the data you have. You can do ensemble models. You can always collect more data. There are so many things that you can do to make your data performance better for so many models. And so it is hard to know when it's no longer worth it to do that from an individual practitioner point of view, whether it's worth it to have your team continue to polish this one model or whether it's time to stop and start working on exploring a new one per se. And so it can be really hard to tell like when to make that leap because people always want to make those models better and better. And I know data folks always have ideas for what they can do to make their models better and they want to pursue them. So especially as a manager, it can be hard to help people make that decision for themselves and get that perspective. We actually kind of changed our entire workflow of our team in a way that made this much easier. Our team had come into Warby as like a team of consultants. We ran the small consultancy called Polynumeral, where we did data science projects for venture-backed startups, for NASA, for like New York Public Radio, which is what does Radiolab, and a bunch of other interesting clients from all sectors. And so we came in with a consulting approach to things. We also had less overlapping skill sets at that point in time than the team did later. And so we would pick a person and put them on a project, and they would do that until it was done or delivered, which is, as we just said, hard to tell when to call something done. And then when they were done with that, we would have them roll up onto a new thing. And so this had a bunch of problems to it. It wasn't really the best way to organize our work because people would feel stuck on a project if it ended up going long. Like we had one data scientist who was on a very crucial project to help Warby make a multi-million dollar decision about where to put its second lab, which is a facility that like cuts out your glasses and sends them to you when you order them. You can't A/B test where to put a multi-million dollar facility, right? So you have to do some pretty sophisticated modeling and projections. We did these like billions of simulations of where all these glasses would go to figure out where the best place is for shipping networks and logistics. And so that's an important problem. We were working directly with one of the CEOs on that problem, but we kept having more questions to go into. So the project ended up going longer than we estimated it would take because we found some surprising stuff in the numbers, which actually changed the decisions. So it was really important, but he ended up being on that project for a little longer. He was getting a little bit burned out on it, not knowing when it was going to end. So that's one issue. Another is it makes it hard to pair and like line up data scientists together so they can collaborate on a given project if they're all on different timelines. And so we picked up the system called ShapeUp, which is, there's a book of that name by the Basecamp team and Ryan Singer from that team. And it is an unusual way of structuring work that kind of like turns a few things on its head. And I thought we could maybe adapt it to our system, but it ended up being perfect for us right out of the box. And it's probably the best thing I did in all of my time there. I think it was the biggest impact thing. My team loved it. I think a direct quote was like, it's hard to imagine working any other way now, which was, So it worked really nicely specifically for data science stuff.
Can you say a few words about how that framework works?
There's a lot of detail on the book, which is free online. So you can go Google it. You can also buy a hard copy if you like paper in your hands. And basically what they have you do is shape what's called a pitch. They use the verb shape and pitch is the noun that focuses on the problem. So you have to start by writing down what the problem you're trying to solve is, which is much harder than it sounds. It is such a helpful exercise to be forced to write that down up front. You also write down the appetite. So how much is this problem worth solving? So that helps you make sure you don't come up with these convoluted solutions that are exciting from a technical standpoint, but the problem isn't actually worth it. So it helps you avoid that mismatch, which is all too common. You also scope out the right amount of detail for the project. So you get a few key constraints figured out so that when you hand it off to the practitioner to start working on it, they have enough constraints that they're not trying to boil the ocean, but it's not so specced out and detailed for them that there's no room for their own creativity and leadership. There's no room for them to iterate as they learn stuff. And so you write these pitch documents and then they get all considered on something they call the betting table, where basically you look at all the pitches that are things we could work on for the next 6 weeks. That's how long the cycle is. And basically we're saying like, okay, we think these problems are worth betting 6 weeks of our time on, of having this many people work on it for this amount of time. We think the problem is worth that time. And we think the solution is likely enough to succeed that we're going to take the bet on that. Because you ultimately don't know if it's going to work out. You could try to work on something and it doesn't work for any number of reasons. We all know that. But you're making kind of reasonable guesses. Then you pick your bets. You tell everyone what you're doing and you go work on it for 6 weeks. And you try very hard to focus. That's another thing individual contributors really like about this system is it's very clear what their top priority is for 6 weeks. And they can like really focus and kind of like dive in deep, which they really love. And then you push off as much stuff as you can for the 2 weeks of what they call cool down after the cycle. And that's for all the things that build up, speculative copy meetings or like professional development or getting your HIPAA certification course refinished or whatever, which we have to do every year. That stuff ends up in the cool down breather time period. So that's kind of a quick overview of what the system is. There's more details to it in the book, but it was pretty transformative for our team in a bunch of different ways.
Say more about the benefits of this framework.
Some of the benefits that came out of it were that it helped our estimations because we got a pretty clear sense of how long a cycle was after doing a few of them. So we could tell how long it would take to do things. This will take 2 cycles or this will be like 6. It helped our estimation, which also helped our communication with stakeholders. So it made it easier for us to say like when we could potentially start working on something because we knew what our cycle schedule was. And there were built-in points to give them updates. So we would give an update once per cycle or twice per cycle or something, but it was more built in. It's all too easy to forget to update stakeholders if you don't have like a big shiny thing that you're done with. And so having a built-in cadence to do that was really helpful for building trust with stakeholders. I think we also built faster because we also had points where you have to have something to show, right? At the end of the cycle, you want to either have something shipped or something partially shipped and documented what you do next time or report on what you've learned. But I think it encouraged us to get to that iterative, shippable, showable point much faster. It made pairing much easier to schedule. So putting 2 people or more people on the same projects, that helped with knowledge transfer, that helped with learning from each other. It helped for tapping out if you're just like really sick of a project and you need a change of scene, like it's possible to transfer it to someone else at that point. And one feature of the system that I particularly love is no backlogs. So instead of having a list of things, it's a backlog that's essentially a to-do list. You just haven't started yet, but it's like there lurking in the background all the time. And then you spend a lot of time grooming it and shaping it and prioritizing it and doing all that stuff. They don't do any of that. It's no backlogs. You can keep a list of ideas if you want. That's fine. It can even be for the whole team and centralized. But there's no assumption that you're going to pick that stuff up and ever do it again. You could if you want to, but it's not in the system. And let me tell you, Raph, it is a way better way to live your life. It is. You just feel so much lighter. Two other quick ones. One is that from a like people management point of view, it really helped morale specifically because it gave people a sense of progress. There's this article that I love that has the cool acronym BICEPS, which is describing people's core needs at work. And the I in BICEPS stands for improvement or progress, and a sense that you are moving towards something and not just treading water for a long time on this project that will never end, right? It gives people a sense that they're moving forward through time, which really helps morale. And I think leaders really underestimate how important this is because they're like, they're doing their job and paying them. They should just keep working. It doesn't matter if they feel this way. And you can absolutely take that approach. However, it's so cheap to implement this process of giving people the sense of progress. It's not expensive to do. And if you don't give it to people, they will say they're burning out and it will look and sound like they're burning out, but they're actually discouraged and or bored. And then they quit and then you lose good people. So giving them a sense of improvement and progress is really, don't underestimate it is my advice to you. And then the last benefit is that it helps with this data specific problem of knowing when you're done enough polishing a model and juicing its improvement, trying to get more out of it versus stopping work on that. Good enough for now. Let me turn my attention to this new other project. And so you're basically working backward and using a mindset of instead of asking yourself the question, is this done yet? You're asking yourself the question, what's the best use of this upcoming piece of time? I have an upcoming cycle. What's my best use of the upcoming cycle? Or let's say you get 2 weeks in, you're like, oh my God, this data is like non-existent that I thought I based this whole thing around. I can't actually get it, or it's wrong, or it's missing or something. You still have 4 weeks left in the cycle. So what is the best use of the remaining available time? Starting from that question really transforms prioritization and workflow and makes a lot of things so much simpler.
What makes you say that it's maybe uniquely well-suited for data science teams?
I think the reason it's so uniquely suited to data science teams is that, especially if you're in a situation where you're building new models and not just iterating on existing ones, is that there is a pretty significant amount of risk in the design process as you're getting those projects spun up. And we have all of the similar challenges that engineering teams have because we have to engineer the thing we're going to do, right? So we have all those risks. But then we also have business risk. So when you're at the process of figuring out what you should make, like a lot of times, and this is changing over the years as more business executives and product managers and people become more familiar with data, machine learning, things you can do with it. But there is a still, they're not practitioners, right? They're not in this all day, every day. So it's hard for them to tell what's easy and what's hard. And sometimes they have pain points or things they want to do or business problems, but they're not sure what solutions are feasible or reasonable or what would be helpful. And so when you're in that process of scoping out new problems, you have to be able to like bridge that communication gap with them as collaborators, as co-creators of this project. And so there's a certain amount of risk. So you may start talking to one stakeholder and then find out that they're asking for something. But when you're like, one of my favorite questions for this is, what will you do with this once you have it? Because that tells you so much about the business problem. One fun fact is I've been asked in my career, I've been doing data science for 12-ish years now. And in my whole career, I've been asked for dashboards so many times. And I have only actually built one dashboard because usually people don't need a dashboard. Almost no one needs a dashboard. If you ask the question, what will you do with this dashboard? What if this number goes way up? What would you do? What action would you take after that number goes up? It turns out they don't need a dashboard. They just need to be notified if the number is going up, right? Asking this question of what will you do once you have this is a really key question for scoping out those problems. Another one of my favorite techniques is prototyping. So like, I think designers do this for like wireframing, where you would make low fidelity wireframes of app interfaces. So you could show people a sketch, but not have it look so polished that they're distracted by the details. And we use similar things in data science stuff. So we will fabricate a graphic or like draw something on paper or like make up data and then plot it or something to give people a concrete sense of stuff, because oftentimes they have trouble articulating what it is they need, but they know when they see it and that's not right. And then they can really tell you. So I have one example from the retail store placement project I worked on, which was one of my first projects at Werby. I came in as a senior data scientist, and this was back when they had 24 stores. They currently have about 250, so about 10 times as many. And at that time, they had 5 or 6 stores, I think, in New York. But then there were a lot of cities in the U.S. where they didn't have any stores. And so the real estate team was faced with the question of, should we put our 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th store in New York, or should we put our first store in Lexington, Kentucky, or another smaller market? And that choice isn't obvious because those cities are smaller than New York. But if you put too many stores in New York, like, you kind of oversaturate it. There's this term that I don't love, but it's industry standard term called cannibalize. And so if you put a store right next to your existing store, you're not going to get new customers, right? You're going to, quote unquote, cannibalize from the existing customers who go to that existing store. And so that is real no matter where in the city you put it, but quantifying that is something that's not, it's pretty sophisticated on how you do it. When we were in this process of shaping that project with them, they said, hey, we want to figure out like where we should put our stores. And we were like, cool. We made up a map, just showed them a map of like the US with the states and then New York City, and each region was a different color, which is called the chloroplast map. And we thought they would love this. And they were like, no, we don't need a map. We need a table. And we were like, oh, okay. So we made the same data, but just in table form. And we showed them that. And they were like, so we were like this. And they were like, no, 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 not like that. And it turns out their deal flow works really differently than we thought. They don't go, okay, like Greenwich Village is the place to be. We're going to go find a store in Greenwich Village. Their deal flow is actually like inbound. So they have realtors who come in and are like, hey, this storefront's available in Greenwich Village. Do you want it? Yes or no? And they have to decide yes, no. So this might sound mathematically like what used to be called the secretary problem. I hope we've renamed it since the 50s. But you have deals come in, and do you say yes or no to these candidates as they come in? And how do you decide that? So instead, what they needed was they needed to know, okay, if we put a store at this open storefront in Greenwich Village, how much will it make in the first year? How much will it cannibalize from existing stores? And they're also looking at a huge number of other factors for that storefront. And they put all that information together into a yes, no decision. But this would be a key input into that decision. So then we're like, okay, we don't need a map. We don't need a table. We just need something where you can send it an address and it will send you back a prediction. And that's all we need. So they were like, yes, that is what we need. So they were excited about that. Once they saw it, they could say a yes or no, but it was hard for them to describe in the abstract what it is they needed until we went through this design process in the Stanford D school sense of the word design with them. So that's the question, what will you do with this once you have it? And mockups are two key ingredients in kind of like, we'll articulate what it is that they need and what would be really useful and transformative for their workflow.
I love that. That's super helpful. At my nonprofit, US Digital Response, we had this saying called demos, not memos.
I love that.
If you just send each other documents with like requirements and specs back and forth forever, it's not a guarantee that you end up building the right thing. But if you show them a demo that you made in 5 minutes on a whiteboard or a piece of paper, they say, that's exactly what I want, or absolutely not, do this instead. But it seems to be helpful for people to have something to react to. And it sounds like that's also been true in your experience as a data scientist.
It's so helpful to make things tangible and real so they can kind of imagine themselves using it, see how it would fit into the business flow or into the customer flow. But making something really tangible so you can see what it will look like in the end is super helpful and really helps with the design process. And also us figuring out how to make some decisions around the math, like how to tune your models, right? There are some cases where you really don't want to undershoot something, or you really don't want to overshoot something, and you want to err on one side or the other. And there's also some cases where the amount of error or lack of precision, or however you want to quantify that, depending on the situation, those metrics really matter or they don't matter at all. And it's important to get clear on that and to be really clear with the stakeholders on that. Because one of the biggest obstacles that we came across with stakeholders is that especially a company like Warby Parker is very deliberate about how it does its branding. The stores are gorgeous. They're super beautiful, natural wood, brass everywhere. They've got art from a local artist in every store from the area. The branding is just so impeccably done. And so it's not really possible to build a model that is perfect, that performs exactly how you'd want it to in every situation. It is very expensive to do that, like, put it that way. And so you have to be comfortable with a certain amount of error and kind of design that into the product that you're making as well. But communicating that to stakeholders can be tricky. And so sometimes you can use these sorts of prototypes are like, what happens if we're off by 20% down or up, like in this prediction? Those sorts of questions can help you get on the same page about like what tolerances are, not just the form of what the output of the model will look like, but also the range of possible responses it could give in different situations. It's important to get on the same page about like which of those ranges are acceptable and which are not. Sometimes it really matters. Sometimes it doesn't matter at all, which is very freeing. But being on the same page about that is important to prevent disappointment. Doing it like gives that one weird response to that one edge case input, right? being like, hey, we talked about this. This is a possible thing that happens, can really help people from pulling the plug on the whole project.
I love the powerful questions and techniques that you've talked about so far. Just out of curiosity, can I mine your brain for any more? Anything else come to mind when you think of like the questions that really illuminate the state of the problem as the stakeholder understands it?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the number one thing is to understand what the business is doing and the big picture of what they're trying to accomplish and where your work fits in with what they're doing now. And an important thing to do in that is there's two super crucial elements. And when I'm hiring data scientists for this sort of role, I make sure to look for these. One is a complete lack of arrogance. I think a lot of times data practitioners think they like know this like hotshot, high paid skill set, and they come in and they like, or the experts were coming in to like save people. And people can smell that. They can hear, they pick up on that. They notice that. And so folks who know that they do have a specialized skill set that their stakeholders do not, that doesn't mean that they're like super secret ninjas who like, or wizards, or they're superior in any way, right? Coming in, knowing you're collaborating on a project, your stakeholders know the domain much better than you do. You know data much better than they do. Together, you can make something beautiful. The other thing I'd say is to not be afraid to ask stupid questions. And if words go by that you don't understand, or you're like, hey, how does it actually work to like walk me through a deal flow of like picking a place to build a new store? What starts that process? What kicks it off? Like, how do you make that decision? What are you currently using to decide it? What are your issues or concerns with it? And so like asking those like dumb questions to make sure you understand what you're walking into is really important. And so many people skip that step because they don't want to look like they don't know what they're doing. And they don't want to waste people's time, but it is actually crucial background to understand the business context of the work you're doing. And I think that is very important in engineering, and it's even more important in data science stuff because you can come back with numbers, right? That, and the stakeholder won't have any way of knowing what assumptions you made that may be completely off. And so I would argue it's actually more important in data work to really understand the business underpinnings of what you're modeling.
Is it fair to say that your organization at Warby Parker was pretty centralized? It sounds like you were, in a way, the work you did was kind of shaped like a consultancy.
Yeah, I think that's fair because Warby is such a vertically integrated company that they have teams that do everything from real estate to eyewear design to marketing to so many different functions. And each of these functions, they had analysts embedded on their teams. So they did the heavy lifting on the day-to-day reporting, any kind of BI needs the team has had. And so that freed up our team, which was centralized, to do more like predictive analytics, more advanced modeling stuff that required a little bit more technical firepower, and also later on some machine learning stuff and working with engineering on that.
That makes sense. And it's my understanding that's fairly common in many orgs. I'm really curious to hear more about what a healthy relationship looks like between a visiting data scientist and the analyst who like is boots on the ground embedded in that team. Do you have any advice either for the analyst or for the data scientist on how to cultivate a healthy relationship?
Yeah, what an interesting question. Yeah, I think that is a really tricky one to navigate. And I have seen the more common pattern I've seen is people being like embarrassed about their spreadsheet that they've made, and they see it as like hacky or unsophisticated. And I see it as very creative and resourceful, and they're doing a ton with the tools that they have, like really pushing, in some cases, Google Sheets beyond its limits. You know, we saw some pretty creative stuff from folks. And I think, you know, getting your mindset right is always first. Going in, knowing where their expertise is and what you're looking to them for in your head, and then you'll say the right things if you get your mindset right. And not saying things like, I'm going to replace you with an algorithm. Maybe don't say that to people, because I've heard people say that. I've had to walk in after other people have said that to people, and it takes a long time to repair that trust because...
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that's an actual quote. So, yeah. So don't say that to people is step one. Yeah, I think like looking to them, this is part of asking them about their business problem, is you're looking to them as the experts of what makes most sense to do and making it clear that you need their input on that and that you're here to help with that and explore and see what things are worth working on together. I think if you get your mindset right, the rest will follow in the way you're thinking about your partnership with them. It also helps to have someone who, we had one member of the team who she made these really great, she came into Warby as an analyst on a different team, not on the data science team, and ultimately transferred onto our team. And the way she was onboarded to Looker was like so tumultuous. And she was like pretty furious when she was like, this is just a pivot table in Excel. Like, why did no one say that to me? This didn't have to be this hard. And I was like, why don't you make the training that you would have wanted to have? Because I'm sure you're not the only one having this experience. We've got hundreds of people using Looker and like, we can do better here, right? And so she made the training she wanted and gave it and went on to make more trainings and did an incredible job of increasing the uptake in Looker and also the skill level of people using it. And she also had this very disarming, like people would tell her things they wouldn't tell someone with a title data scientist. And so she was very good at getting them to trust her and show her their quote unquote ugly spreadsheet. And that was another way we found a lot of kind of rich veins of people to work with was through someone like that. So sometimes having a non-quote data scientist on your team can also be really helpful.
Wow, that person had a superpower.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What's the most recent tool or app that changed your life?
I'm not really able to write a ton of code right now because I'm focusing on other things at the moment. And it's an itch that I need to scratch because I really love it. And I'm finding my outlet for that right now is actually Apple Shortcuts, which is this tool that they built in, which is kind of like in theory, it's a no-code tool. In practice, you actually have to be a programmer to figure out how to use it, where you can write these little programs to automate things on your phone, your watch, your computer. It's a little hard to figure out at first, but once you figure it out, it's like very addictive. And so I have like probably a couple hundred of these that use regularly. And some of them I use on demand and some of them are automated. I have something that runs every half hour and like checks for rain because I live in Los Angeles and it never rains here, but sometimes it does. And then you wish you'd brought in the cushions for outside, you know? So it like notifies me if rain's coming up and I should take action.
That's actually totally amazing. I feel like I've made maybe 3 Apple Shortcuts ever. And then I was like, I give up. This is too complex. I've never heard of anyone who has hundreds of shortcuts.
There's a subreddit full of people who do. It's called Our Shortcuts. They're my people.
Wow. Talk about automating your life. That's amazing. You don't even need AI. If people want to find out more about what you're working on, where can they find you? And what are you working on?
What am I working on? That's a great question to ask. Right now, I'm actually taking a little bit of a breather from running data science teams. And I'm currently shifting gears for a sec into offering executive and leadership coaching stuff. It was a part of my role I really loved. It was like working with people one-on-one. I work with directors, VPs, CEOs, CTOs of small to medium high growth startups. I also work with entrepreneurs and founders of smaller non-VC businesses. And I only work with folks who believe in the humanity of their teams and that they're not just cogs. We want to treat them like people. And so I work with folks in a mix of modes. Sometimes they're looking for clarity. So they want to sort out their thinking, make a decision, get unstuck on something that they've been stuck on for a while. Or sometimes they're in execution mode. They know what they want, but they don't really know how to get there. So one example is like if you're an early employee at a company and you're seeing your peers get hired over, like bringing outside people to replace them as the company grows, but you don't want that to happen to you. You know what you want, but you don't know how to get there, right? And then sometimes it's just a place to be heard. Like, the higher you go in leadership, the more you're expected to be self-managing, and also the more you are people look to you and you have to make hard calls without all the information. And so those roles are lonely. It's a lot of responsibility and you don't usually have peers that you can talk to candidly. People look for coaches for clarity, execution, help, support, accountability, and then also just to have a place to like vent and like be seen and like be messy so you can bring your more organized self back to your role. So that's my work right now. I'm really enjoying it. And you can find more about me at sashalandy.com. So that's sashalandy.com. And yeah, feel free to reach out.
Fabulous. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is so fun, Rap.
Hey, it's Raf again. I'm here to share my high-level takeaways from my conversation with Sasha. First, consider the shape-up methodology to make development more predictable. Shape-up starts with working with stakeholders to write tightly scoped pitches, which is kind of a forcing function to help people pin down exactly the problem they want to solve. Then you get the company or functional leaders together to decide which of those pitches to work on. They call it placing your bets. Then teams get stuff done in 6-week cycles, followed by a 2-week cooldown period. Sasha said her team loved it. Someone told her, "It's hard to imagine working any other way now." It helped her team with estimations, set a regular cadence of communication with stakeholders, avoided the backlog trap, gave her data scientists a sense of momentum and forward progress in their careers, and helped them make the best use of their time in cycle. ShapeUp was originally designed for software engineering teams, so it's interesting to hear that it might work even better for data science and machine learning teams. Second, Sasha shared a few best practices for communicating with stakeholders. My favorite quote from the whole interview is when she said, "Your stakeholders know the domain much better than you do. You know data much better than they do. Together, you can make something beautiful." But data is hard to communicate, even for data practitioners, let alone non-practitioners. Sasha asks questions like, "What will you do with this once you have it?" to understand the true intention behind the stakeholder's request. She also uses quick and dirty mockups to give people something tangible to react to. I'm glad we also talked about the role of humility in design work. Domain experts really hate it when hotshot technical folks walk in to save the day. Along those lines, we also talked a little bit about org design. I've worked with both centralized and matrix data teams, and there are definitely some interesting trade-offs between those two models. A reasonably common org design pattern is when you have a centralized AI, ML, or data team and embedded data analysts spread around the org in their own teams. We talked about what makes a good partnership between the touring data scientist and the embedded analyst. They both have things the other person needs. In Sasha's view, if you get the mindset right, the behavior and partnership follow. That's it for our second episode. If you liked it, remember to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and consider leaving a review. It helps the show get visibility. See you next time.